This is Coxie FM 97.0.
He told her that, you know, he, you know, a friend of his invited him to church and now he's saved and he's also on this new spiritual journey with the Lord. And that's where the sparks flew, because actually she had prayed for God to make him and her work together, because she told God that, you know, I really want to date this guy. I really want this guy to be my husband. Lord, if you can fix it,
please. The hormone. Balance his hormones.
It's other things.
Mighty Father.
Because he can do all things.
I like you now, rata fornication in that. Muluki, sekonyana ulo.
Your Coxie FM.
It is exactly 7 minutes after 7 o'clock on Coxie FM 97.0. A very warm welcome to the second and final hour of the interview. My name is Ace Moloi with Retabile Mabi Hopolang on production. And at this point, you know, as always, it's a Monday, so it's time for us to get to hashtag books according to Refilwe, which is where we have an on-air book club and we get to talk about books. And remember, I did say that since we've entered into Freedom Month, which is April, and we're marking 25 years since we had the advent of democracy here in South Africa, we decided that we're going to be commemorating this milestone of 25 years through literature. Basically, what you do is that you look into some of these narratives that we don't always talk about. I mean, in the clutter of pop culture, in the clutter of social media trends, of so many other things happening, there's really no space to be having these moments of reflecting. So we're using this moment, this literary space, where we reflect on this and many other things. And tonight, as Refilwe joins us, we're going to be looking at Thabo Mbeki, The Dream Deferred, which is a biography written by Mark Gevisser. It's about former President Thabo Mbeki, and it was published in 2008 by Jonathan Ball. And the book, of course, is a major contribution to the post-apartheid South African discourse through the life of a very interesting person, Thabo Mbeki. And this is why I say Thabo Mbeki is very interesting. Number one, Thabo Mbeki occupies one of the most central positions in the story of post-apartheid South Africa, as first someone who was very, very instrumental when it comes to the process that led to the negotiations, or our so-called negotiated settlement, but also as someone that was the deputy president of a new democracy under the leadership of Ntate Nelson Mandela. As the DP, Thabo Mbeki was seen to be the prime minister, the de facto president, basically someone who is in charge of government, while Nelson Mandela was going around mobilizing and trying to get support from international communities to advance this reconciliation agenda of basically rebuilding South Africa from the very ashes of racism. And so he becomes very central also because he became the second democratically elected president of South Africa, and he led our country for almost 10 years. And something very interesting and tragic happened where we saw his removal. I mean, just at the mention of the name of Thabo Mbeki, you have so many other ANC patriarchs that are coming up. You have the history and legacy of Oliver Tambo. You have the likes of Nelson Mandela. You have Chris Hani. You have Jacob Zuma. You have Cyril Ramaphosa. And many more others that are just intertwined with this web that is surrounding former President Thabo Mbeki. Therefore, in my view, it is very absolutely impossible to tell the story of a democratic South Africa without mentioning the name of Thabo Mbeki. But I think the first question that comes to your mind is, who exactly is this man, this figure? And this is why Refilwism is joining us tonight, as we're going to be talking more about him. Welcome first to Coxie FM, Refilwe. We love having you here all the time.
Oh, thank you so much, Ace. I love being here all the time.
How was your reading experience of the book?
Yeah. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. My gosh. I must say before anything else that, guys, this book is loaded with information. It has so much information. It's actually really overwhelming. Mm. And another thing I'd like to note before you guys get this book is the fact that with books such as these, specifically political books, if I may mention, you need to take your time when you read books like this, because obviously, like I mentioned, there's so much information and there's so many things that you can even miss if you're in a hurry. So I really would like to encourage that when you do read this book, when you finally get your hands on it, take your time reading it, because I promise you, it's very interesting.
Now, a lot of things have been said about Thabo Mbeki.
Yes.
You know, and they come up in the book.
Mm.
He's described as someone that is aloof, someone that's very intelligent, someone that is also shy,
yeah,
but also even ruthless.
Yes.
But I think all these descriptions go back to the kind of childhood that he had.
Yes.
Now, as a person that went through the biography of the man, what kind of childhood would you say he had, looking also into the family dynamics, some kind of a brief profile maybe on his parents, and just basically the kind of child that he was, so that we can understand how he was developed by circumstances to become the person that we now describe at this point?
Okay, so Thabo Mbeki was born and raised in Beuleni in the Eastern Cape. He's one of four children of Mpanet and Govan Mbeki. Thabo attended primary school in Idukia and Butterworth, and then acquired a secondary education at Lovedale in Alice. Both of his parents were educated, his mother was a teacher, and his father was highly involved in the struggle. His father was also a teacher. I need to note that that's actually very important. His father was also a teacher before he became very highly involved in the struggle. His mother in particular stressed on the importance of education. And just like I had mentioned, his father, he was arrested in the Rivonia trial. He was a member of the SACP. He was, you know, he was leading the Umkhonto weSizwe together with Nelson Mandela. He was a store owner, and he began a writing career at the New Age on the editorial board. So you can already see the dynamics of this family. You can see that this was a family where education was placed up there. Because in fact, all of their children, if you read about them, all of their children turned out very well. Education was the order of the day in that household. And Thabo Mbeki himself, he was a quiet child. He never cared to be noticed or relevant. You'll pick that up in the book. He performed very well at school. This man, even today, his brilliance literally outshines the rest. It can't be matched to anyone else. He was a letter reader for illiterate adults. I know that during that time, there were a lot of people, because they were living in a village, basically. And there were, you know, women who had their husbands from Johannesburg who were working as migrant laborers, and they were illiterate. So what he'd do is he'd read letters for them. And what I found amusing in one of the chapters in the book is a part where he had a conversation with his mother, and he said to her that, "Mom, but I'm not supposed to be reading these kind of letters because they're so personal." And the mother actually responded to him, and she said to him that, you know, okay, yes, they are personal, but as long as you just keep them in confidence and you don't tell anyone else. So he was a letter reader. And he certainly wasn't a rebel, as people would think you would be. You know, when you go into politics, you're already seen as a rebel of some sort. But at home also, he was taught to communicate freely, but always also with respect.
Very, very a detailed analysis of the kind of childhood that Thabo Mbeki had, but also even the circumstances.
Mm.
And his father,
yeah,
who was very instrumental when it comes to what one would say is the coming of age of Thabo Mbeki, intellectually speaking,
yeah,
happened to be a revolutionary, a communist, who was, as we said, very instrumental in the forming of MK, who was just a leader of society at that time.
Yes.
What kind of relationship did he have with Thabo Mbeki? Now, looking at the father and son, you know, kind of relationship. And how did it grow and develop as the years of political activism and the struggle against apartheid went by?
Mm. Now, unfortunately, Thabo Mbeki had to grow up very fast. And I say unfortunately because obviously the circumstances made him that much stronger. And his father was not a person who was around a lot. Obviously, during that time, it was very common for fathers, especially those who were in the struggle, to be very absent. They were absent fathers. And it was the same case with Govan Mbeki. Govan himself, actually, in the book, mentions that he's very apologetic and he regrets it. You know, he does state that he was actually an absent father, not just to Thabo, but to the rest of his kids. So Thabo didn't actually have a relationship with his father. You know, I'd say that, you know, the relationship that they had was a very dispassionate one. There was no sentiment. There were no sentiments between the two of them. There's a part in the book where it says, where it's written that the only time there was actually communication at all was when Thabo graduated from Sussex. A letter was written, and then again after he got married to Zanele, which was not much. And I suppose you can say that it was expected because, like I said before, when the struggle happened, a lot of fathers were absent. It was just the order of the day. So I think the mother being in the household and having the home front covered, she literally took on the role of a father, even though the father can't really be replaced. But he was absent for most of the time.
And he was a father.
Yeah.
To many other activists, yes, just
definitely.
Not to his kids.
Not just to his
I mean,
kids.
One of the people that he fathered was Jacob Zuma on Robben Island. But also, he had a very close relationship with Chris Hani also. Mm-hmm. But we'll get to that because those two comrades that I've mentioned also grew up to become some of the, not only contemporaries of Thabo Mbeki, but also even rivals at different epochs in history. Mm-hmm. We'll talk more about that. But let's talk about political activism now.
Yes.
When was Thabo Mbeki's first encounter with politics?
Okay, so initially he had wanted to be an activist and be a part of a party at the age of 10, but unfortunately he was too young at that age. Then over time, when he hit 14, he went on to join the ANC Youth League. He had his first encounter of racism at Lovedale. Because Lovedale was... It was a prestigious institution. Everyone from the Eastern Cape knows that it was a prestigious institution, and it was very missionary. It was mixed. So right there and then, he had his first encounter of racism. One of the schoolboys from around the village was being taunted by another, and they were saying one kafir, two kafir, three kafirs, and they were just taunting him over and over again. So this was his first encounter. While he was still at Lovedale, the institution was placed under the authority of Bantu Affairs. By 1959, he was expelled because he partook in strikes. Very soon after that, he became the organizing secretary of the ANC Youth League, the Lovedale branch. By this time, he was already nearly 17.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that, activism was in him. And I love this because it also shows you that he paved his own path. It wasn't because his father went into politics.
Mm-hmm.
As you read the book, you'll find that, most of the book, it talks about him, obviously. They're just parts of his father that are spoken about. But you'll see that activism was something that was in his blood, literally. Because even when he left the country and he went into exile, he continued with his activism. It didn't just end here.
And his father, in fact, was very discouraging of Thabo Mbeki getting into politics.
Yes.
One of the forces behind him going to exile to basically study was because his father was setting him up for that.
Yes.
Didn't want him to go. He wanted to go into the trenches and be one with the masses and be a soldier and fight, for the liberation of the people. But his father was like, no, you're going to go to school. And he was sort of scammed, I would say, into going to school because he didn't think that he was going to school. He thought it was en route to go into the trenches and those other things. We're sitting at just 19 minutes after 7 o'clock. This is Kofsi FM 97.0. And at this point, we're having hashtag books according to Refilwe. We're looking at a very interesting book. Hi, Bahoso Ibali. I get to be here because if we were to get the Moody's to come and battle check our credit status, ya how ya library, ya how bookshelf, ya how ya bolela ne battle reki junk status.
This is Kofsi FM 97.0.
Would you say Bloemfontein is not a supportive city, or would you say the artists in Bloemfontein are not selling their work to the people that we have in the city?
The biggest problem I have, especially with some of the artists and creators I've worked with, is they don't understand the importance of having social media presence. To them, it's thinking, okay, I have a Facebook page or I have a Twitter page, and that's sufficient. But if I go to an event and I see you perform, and then I hear your handle or I hear your details, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Twitter, I'm going to go to SoundCloud, I'm going to go to Instagram, I'm going to go to various social media platforms to look for you and to see what other material I can find. And it's surprising that when you do that, they don't have social media pages. They don't have any engagement. They don't have any activity.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's the same people that turn around and say Bloom people don't support. But what can they support when on your social media page, all you have is pictures of your dog, pictures of your child, pictures that are not related to your brand itself. You can't be a musician and you have pictures or you have content which is unrelated to the brand that you're selling to the people.
If you did something simple and you go onto your Instagram and let's say you search Johannesburg and then you search Bloemfontein.
Mm-hmm.
The differences will be glaring in the fact that, in Joburg you have business advertisements, businesses that are linked to social media and all of those things. But here, Kimajita, they're chilling. They're showing you pictures of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fact that other places have been able to monetize social media and social media culture has been a big deal for the strength of social media. And here, there's no belief in that sort of advertising, that sort of platforms from corporate or from public enterprises as a whole. And I think that is a big part of it. But I mean, there's so many layers to it. I mean, even the fact that as a free state, I don't believe that our people are on YouTube enough. Platforms that actually make this successful were more a Facebook sort of province than anything.
KOFCFM. The interview on KOFCFM with Ace Moloi.
We're sitting at just 21 minutes after 7 o'clock. This is KOFCFM 97.0. We're having one of those off-air conversations that get you confused when it's time for you to go on air because there's so many things that are happening. But we're still with Refilwe Zim, and at this point we're talking about Thabo Mbeki, The Dream Deferred, which is a biography on the lives and times of former President Thabo Mbeki, and it's written by Mark Gevis. I'm going to go through some of the comments that you shared with us on our socials, but before that we need to continue with our conversation, Le Refilwe. And earlier on, I mentioned something about Thabo Mbeki going to exile in 1962, and so many things happened in that process. Of course, we can't cover, you know, everything else that's related to just that moment. But fast forward to him now being in London, in England. Mm. So many things happening. The 60s, the 50s, that period was called some kind of a renaissance era, because everyone was just getting liberated.
Yes.
Young people were having sex.
Like nobody's business.
Like nobody's business. Everyone was just expressing themselves, even intellectual.
Rock and roll, sex, drugs, and everything else.
Everything else was just coming. It's like Bramfontein in England. Damn.
Perfect caption right there.
But where was Thabo Mbeki during all these things, and what was he busying himself with?
So like you mentioned, Thabo Mbeki moved to London, and he had moved there to work for the ANC full-time in the propaganda section. And like you had just mentioned, now this was the swinging London period. And, you know, he found that people there were really liberal. Not only were they liberal, but they were really spontaneous too. Comrades from South Africa would meet up and form small communities. You know, he knew that Europeans craved authenticity. So he became more intentional in promoting anti-apartheid activism amongst the people there. He was in a relationship with the white lady, Anne Nicholson. She was actually from South Africa herself. And she also ended up there during the struggle. And, you know, with all these things that they were being invited to, unfortunately, this relationship ended because of her insecurities. Mm-hmm. Because she says that whenever they would go to, you know, social settings, parties or anything like that, he seemed to fit in more than she did, which you would find strange because he's black and she's white. Mm-hmm. And you think that because she's white, she knows the culture, even if it's like in another country, totally different. Mm-hmm. But she said that she felt insecure because he would fit in, and he was even actually called, I don't know what the exact word for it is, but let's call it an Oreo. You know, people who are called Oreos in South Africa, you know, those white people in black skin kind of, kind of people.
Coconut.
So, yeah, coconut. Mm-hmm. There it is. Coconut. So when he got there, he was called an Oreo. It was misunderstood why he was really gelling so well with white people from that side. So that relationship ended. It was on and off, actually.
She probably didn't know that black don't crack.
Black don't crack at all, honey. So then with all of this happening, Moiletsi Mbeki, who is Thabo's brother, youngest brother, he also arrived in Britain, and he gave account that a section of the ANC got locked into the Soviet Union, and that weakened their ability to operate. Mm-hmm. So actually, he was, you know, with Moiletsi's arrival, he was very unhappy. And I remember in the book, it says that he told his mother, and the mother then told Thabo that, you know what, you need to sort of accommodate your brother. What's going on? And, you know, Thabo responded and he said, no, but mom, we're all students. I mean, we're not going to now accommodate one person just because it's uncomfortable. He needs to get with the times. He needs to move with us. So with all of that happening, Thabo went on and mobilized the students to be active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. He busied himself with the struggle for nuclear disarmament, protested against increases in fees for foreign students, and also participated in solidarity struggles for people in Zimbabwe, Greece, Cyprus, and Spain, just to mention a few. So, the fame of the ANC grew through his participation a lot, and it fueled his interest also in the African Renaissance.
Now, that's one of the things, in fact, not one, but the most central contribution that Thabo Mbeki made into the, you know, mass democratic movement was how he was able to be an advocate, basically, to write articles, to engage, to negotiate, to have those debates with people, because he seems to have not been gifted when it comes to Mratata.
But, you know, also on the African Renaissance itself, I don't know if you guys know, but He has a partnership at the moment, even with UNISA, where there's actually a module that you can study. It's I think it's the Thabo Mbeki African Renaissance Leadership
Institute.
Temali. Yes. So I think it's just so beautiful how he's making it open to everyone, and it's not just a theory that was put there and that was basically it.
And having said the kind of aptitude that he had when it comes to politics.
Yes.
And how at some point his political tactics would, you know, sometimes cause tension between him and his comrades within the movement. And we know one of those people that were, you know, always taking Thabo Mbeki on a number of issues is Chris Hani.
Yes.
And they happen to be peers.
Mm.
They happen to have, I think they were at Lovedale together.
They were.
And they had what Mark Gevisser describes as parallel paths to power. Why was there rivalry between Thabo Mbeki and Chris Hani as far as the book is concerned?
So, as you know, Chris and Thabo were actually both in Mkhonto weSizwe. So, he was very keen on infiltrating more cadres in, you know, and arms in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Thabo was on the opposite end. Thabo wanted to have talks on talks.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris was more here. Like, he was very militant.
Mm-hmm.
So Chris thought that apartheid would go on for another 10 plus years. And this was like in the late 80s or so, he was estimating. And, you know, with time, he thought, okay, but white people are already killing us. So come on, let's attack. What are we waiting for anyway? And Thabo wanted to speak, like I had just said. So whilst Thabo was so sure that by 1990 the dust will have settled, Chris really thought that by, you know, apartheid would only end in the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the path to power was actually also Joe Slover's brainchild initially. It was a means of an enemy strategy to disarm the liberation movement. So in case people are just, you know, confused as to what it really was.
You are speaking like a card. Speaking, you know, politics of capacity.
You know, we need to simplify.
Yeah.
So basically it was a means of an enemy strategy to disarm the liberation movement. So Thabo insinuated that Chris thought that they were selling out talks with the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So whilst he wanted to have talks, I think Chris thought that he was selling out to the enemy. And I know this also came up again with Mandela. The
mm-hmm.
same thing came up with him.
Mm-hmm.
People were saying that whilst they were having private talks on the side, he was actually being a sellout. So this was one of the main things that, you know, made the feathers ruffle a lot.
Feathers also ruffled a lot. lot.
Yes.
At Polokwane in 2007.
Yeah.
The elective conference of the African National Congress, yeah. Thabo Mbeki up against Jacob Zuma.
Yeah.
But these were people who were friends before.
Yeah.
They met in exile. Mm. They became very close confidantes.
One was mentored by the other's father.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then met the son. And the son took on the duty of educating.
Yes.
Even teaching him how to use a gun.
Use a gun.
From dismantling it to loading,
yeah.
to doing everything pertaining to a gun that Jacob Zuma knows he was taught by Thabo Mbeki.
Mm.
And then we came to democratic dispensation. Thabo Mbeki becomes the president, Jacob Zuma the deputy president.
Yes.
Somewhere, somehow, there's a clash when it comes to morals and ethics and understandings of politics between the two men. But before we get to that, how would you distinguish Jacob Zuma from Thabo Mbeki based on their posture and outlook as far as politics is concerned?
I think, you know, as far as the leadership styles are concerned, I would put it that way. They're very different. They're worlds apart. Thabo Mbeki is more, I would say he's not as humanistic, if there's such a word. He doesn't have a humanistic approach
mm-hmm.
to politics.
It's
very straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
He's practical. You know, he thinks everything through and there must be, I think he's more of a, he thinks everything through.
Doesn't give hugs and kiss babies.
Winnie
Mandela
knows.
Doesn't
kiss babies that he doesn't know and those he probably knows. But you know, he's a person who is very practical more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look at Jacob Zuma, he sort of wins you over. And
he's
he
charming.
Deceives at the same time. Yes, it's
very
that charm.
Mm-hmm.
He's very charming and he wins you over. And before you know it, you fall in the trap and you've been deceived. You know, like for instance, with you know, the rape trial, his rape trial that happened. I think for me, that was one of the biggest things. I don't know how he slid out of that so quickly and so slyly. But it, you know, this guy, I promise you, he's got ways.
Mm-hmm.
He has got ways. He's literally dodged bullets the most.
Because, I mean, one of his responsibilities in Natal was to make sure that he infiltrates, you know, and runs an underground movement of
yes.
smuggling arms in
yes.
and out of South Africa.
Mm.
And they've always wanted to capture him and they could not.
Yes.
At some point, I remember he made a joke and he said that he could bewitch the police of the time, and there's some mugwe of a journalist that took it literally.
That actually took it
literally. Yes, and now they said Jacob Zuma said he practiced witchcraft during apartheid. But we're running out of time,
yes,
because I wanted us to draw those parallels between the two men, because as we speak at this point, I don't think that the ANC would ever, in the nearest future, recover from Polokwane 2007. And I think I found it to be so profound that the breaking away or the friendship breakup of these two men,
yes,
could be so explosive that,
yes,
the whole movement had to implode when, yeah, they decided that we are no longer seeing eye to eye and we are fighting, because everything else that we see happening in the ANC traces back,
yeah,
to the relationship between Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma. And that would be one of the legacies, I think,
yes,
for people that are members of the ANC. They would say, would remember Thabo Mbeki for the role that he played,
yeah,
in the dividing of the ANC,
sure,
moments leading to Polokwane, the firing of Jacob Zuma, and many other things, regardless of the emotions and the feelings he had at the time and the rationale behind that. But what else would be a legacy of Thabo Mbeki in your view?
Okay, the first and the most important for me, obviously, would be the African Renaissance. The second would be Thabo Mbeki and his stance on the AIDS saga. This actually... Oh, wow. This had a lot of controversy to it, actually, because, you know, he got a lot of backlash from people, not just in the country, all over the world, because he had said, at first he started off by saying that he didn't really believe, you know, that HIV and AIDS actually existed. I mean, where does it come from, really? And, you know, in the book, he even says that you would think that doctors know more than you think they know, but they actually don't. You think they're scientists, but they don't. Then he went on to actually speak about this at the AIDS conference, and... You know, within his explanations of not seeing the link between HIV and AIDS, it sort of made him look a little strange.
Inhumane
also.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, during that time, obviously it was a huge stigma. It still sort of is right now, but not so much as it was then when it first hit, you know, first came to the country. So I think people were actually taken aback by the fact that, you know, he just seems so inhumane, like you mentioned. Why would he think that, you know, it's not something that exists? Why does he make it seem like it doesn't exist at all? There was that. And then the third legacy also, in our points, would be Thabo Mbeki and Zimbabwe. Now, we all know that he had close relations with Zimbabwe as a country, not just because of the liberation struggle, but also during the xenophobic attacks. I don't know if you remember, during 2008, there was really bad xenophobic attacks. South Africans were saying that Zimbabweans have come to take their jobs and all of that. And, you know, he had to sort of step in and sort of make us see the light and all of that. So he also had said that MK was allowed to move ammunition and cadres through Zimbabwe, like you had mentioned earlier on. A solid partnership had also been formed between the two countries. So we have very close ties with Zimbabwe. And I think, you know, it's very beautiful that he strengthened the ties between our country and theirs. Another thing, you know, that stands out for me the most would be, you know, Thabo Mbeki's stance on education. You can see that, you know, he stands as a role model also for education. The mere fact that he continued studying, even when he was in exile, you know, he got his master's. Even today, you know, with what I had mentioned about his partnership with UNISA, I find it so beautiful that even as he stepped down from presidency, he still goes on and educates the youth. And, you know, it's just so beautiful, really.
And also his African Renaissance.
Yes.
The vision that he had for the self-determination of Africa. I mean, he went as far as declaring the 21st century to be the African century. And a lot of people were very skeptical about what exactly does that mean. I think it's Times Magazine.
Yeah.
They had a very, very negative, you know, front page story about Africa and how it's a dark continent and how nothing good could ever come
out
of that.
We're still changing that narrative.
But he seems to have learned from the likes of Kwame Nkrumah, from the likes of Pixie Isaka Seme, who had long articulated their Pan-Africanism before Thabo Mbeki could even come, you know, to age as far as, you know, intelligence and political consciousness are concerned. Look, we can talk the whole night when it comes to former President Thabo Mbeki.
And his content is very heavy.
I did say that his life is so central to the many other lives of other people that it becomes completely difficult for you to talk about anything about South Africa without talking about him.
Yeah.
Even when you don't want to talk about him, you're going to end up having to talk about him.
Yes.
But now, let's get into the rating of the book.
Okay.
Because in the end, we're not here to just have a truncated biography of Thabo Mbeki.
Yes.
But we're also here to talk literature.
Yeah.
From a literary point of view, how did you rate this book and what kind of criteria did you use to rate the book?
All right. So from a literature point of view, I rated this book a 10 out of 10. And I will tell you why. I need to go in hard on this. Okay, first of all, obviously, we need to take note of the spelling and grammar. Yo, Mark Gevisser, guys, he writes. This person, my goodness, he writes beautifully. I must say, guys, when you start reading this book, you'll find yourself having to most probably use a dictionary. I promise you, you'll have to use a dictionary. I really do encourage that you keep a dictionary handy because it will definitely come in handy. His spelling, his grammar, everything, his vocabulary is amazing. The relevance. I find this book to be very relevant because history does, in fact, repeat itself. Thabo Mbeki is a huge figure, not just in our country, right around the world, throughout. So it's still very relevant, you know, even in years to come from now, even when our children come and their children come, you know, this book will still be relevant because, I mean, like I said, history repeats itself. The third thing I rated it on is the educational value of the book. There is so much to learn from this. I promise you, the information is overwhelming. Like I said before, you will get an information overload. There's so much, just not just about Thabo Mbeki, but just politics, you know, as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was shocked to find out that, you know, there was a certain kind of system, you know, when Thabo Mbeki and Zanele got married, you know, because of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a man, you couldn't get married up until you were about 35, apparently, and you had to be a member for about 10 years. And if you're a woman in the movement, you had to be 25 and had been a member for 5 years. So I was at first I thought, but that's a lot though. I mean, really, why must
I mean, the rationale behind that is that you might be getting married to a spy.
That too, yes, no, definitely.
So you had to be very cautious.
Very cautious.
And I think that's one of the things that a lot of thinkers and commentators attribute the paranoidness of Thabo Mbeki too, because having lived in exile and always knowing that you might be under security surveillance at any point and that whoever you interact with, you must always be very careful as to who exactly is this person and what kind of information can you give to them.
Yes.
And of course, when you come back into a democratic South Africa, you end up not trusting anyone that comes close to you, and that might portray you as paranoid. But let's get to the other one. We're running slightly out of time.
Oh my word. Okay. It's age appropriate. That's another thing I rated it on. The next thing is detailed information. Like I said before, it's very detailed and it's concise. Even though there's a lot of information per chapter, it does get to the point. I mean, I would find that each chapter has about, 6 to 11 pages max, which is not really a lot. But the last thing I will note, once again, for those who missed it in the beginning when I announced it, please, when you read this book, take your time. Please take your time. It's a lot of information, but it's useful information. There's a lot that you can learn from this. Yes.
Sorry. Oh, we feel up, guy?
We gave it a 10 out of 10 because it's outstanding.
10 out of 10 because it is outstanding. We're going to King Yetambukena be outstanding. We're sitting at just 20 minutes heading to 8 o'clock. This is Kofsi FM 97.0 and you're listening to the book segment of the interview, and it's called Hashtag Books According to Refilozim. At this point, there's going to be a moment of silence. We're going to be a moment of silence. Because Rakhadi Refilo utlore balla ho utlore na, why exactly is this book worthy of a 10 out of 10? It's The Dream Deferred by Mark Gevisser, and it looks into the lives and times of Thabo Mbeki.
Mbeki is, at least as much as Mandela, the primary architect of South Africa's transition to democracy and the post-apartheid state. His story provides a key to South Africa's turbulent past, its complicated transition to democracy, and its somewhat perplexing current politics. He was also, in many ways, the architect of his own downfall and his demise. The tragic denouement to a long, illustrious, but highly controversial public career signals a deeply contested legacy. The nature of these contestations themselves reveals much about contemporary South African society.
I am an African. I owe my being to the hills and the valleys, the mountains and the glades, the rivers, the deserts, the trees, the flowers, the seas, and the ever-changing seasons that define the face of our native land. My body has frozen in our frosts and in our latter-day snows. It has thawed in the warmth of our sunshine and melted in the heat of the midday sun. The crack and the rumble of the summer thunders, lashed by startling lightning, have been a cause both of trembling and of hope. The fragrances of nature have been as pleasant to us as the sight of the wild blooms of the citizens of the veld. The dramatic shapes of the Drakensberg, the soil-colored waters of the Likwa, Igqili, Nothukela, and the sands of the Kalahati have all been panels of the set on the natural stage on which we act out the foolish deeds of the theater of the day.
This is Kofsi FM 97.0.